I want to begin in volume four, or continue in volume four, with November the 21st, 1902. As I could neither lose consciousness nor sleep, Louisa said, my poor nature could take no more. But then when I felt convinced more than ever that I would not see Jesus any more, all of a sudden he came, and he made me lose consciousness, which of course means go into ecstasy. I was as though struck by lightning. Who can say my fear? I had no control over myself. It was no longer in my power to regain consciousness. So she was taken suddenly into ecstasy. Now, this has happened to other saints as well. And people feel a lot of fear because, as Louisa says here, you feel you're out of control. Jesus told me, my daughter, do not fear. I have come to strengthen you. That's give you the gift of fortitude. Don't you yourself see that you can take no more and that your nature fails without me? Well, that's John 15:5. Without me, you can do nothing. And Philippians 4:13. With the Lord, I can do all things. And Louisa said to him, ah, my life, without you, I am dead. I feel no more vital strength. You used to form my whole being. And if I do not have you, I lack everything. Indeed, if you continue not coming, I will die of sorrow. That's the Song of Songs, chapter 5, verse 6. And my soul failed at his flight. I sought him, but I did not find him. I called to him, but he did not answer. It's the weeping of the lover for her beloved. And he said, my beloved daughter, you say that I am your life. And I say to you that you are my living life. That's John 14:20-21. You in me and I in you, both completely one. You are my living life. Just as I made use of my humanity to suffer, so I'm using your humanity to continue the course of my sufferings. So that's Colossians 1:24. It makes her a co-redeemer. I'm using your nature to continue the course of my sufferings within you. Therefore, you are all mine. Even more, you are my very life. 1 Corinthians 3:16. Know you not that you are the temple of the living God and the Holy Spirit dwells within you? As he was saying this, I remembered the obedience that the priest and I said to him, Louisa said, my sweet good, will you let me obey by allowing me to come round by myself? And Jesus said, my daughter, I, the Creator, have obeyed the creature, that is the priests, by keeping you suspended in these days. It's only right now for the creature, that is the priest, to obey his Creator by submitting to my will. Because before my divine will, the human reason does not count. And the strongest reason before the supreme will resolves into smoke. That's Romans 11:33-36. So here Jesus is demanding that the priests will acknowledge that it truly is him that is operating in Louisa, and that it is his divine will that they are actually opposing. So Louisa said, who can say how embittered I felt, but I was resigned, making a vow to the Lord never to withdraw my will from his. Now, there's a very important stage. We're still in volume four. And it's not until you get to volume 11 that the full revelation of the divine will be made. But Louisa will already be deeply committed to the divine will long before then. And here she takes a vow never to withdraw her will from the divine will. Not even, she said, for the blink of an eye. And since they, that's the priests, had told me that if I was surprised by that state and would not come round by myself, they would let me die. Now, that's not going to be a problem for Louisa. She's been wanting to die all the time. So because of that, I was preparing myself for death, considering it a great, great fortune. And I prayed the Lord to take me in his arms. So while I was doing this, the confessor came to make me come round, embittering me even more. So much so that seeing me so embittered, the Lord told me in my interior, tell him to concede to me 2 more days of suspension to give him the time to know what to do. So the Lord gives the priest a message through Louisa that he has 2 more days to make up his mind as to what he's going to do. Then the confessor left, leaving me all pierced as though filled with bitterness. And Jesus, letting me hear his voice again, told me, poor daughter, how they embitter you. I feel my heart being lacerated in seeing you like this. And even in saying that, he indicates his very personal love for Louisa. Courage, do not fear, my daughter. And then remember that it is by the intervention of obedience, that is the priest, that you were suspended from this state. So the priests are involved absolutely with this. So this is a struggle, in fact, between the church and the divine will. If now they, the priests, do not want it any more, I will also let you obey. Is this not the nail that pierces you the most, not being able to obey? And Louisa said yes. Well then, I have promised you that I will let you obey. Therefore, I do not want you to embitter yourself any more. However, please tell them, do they want to play games with the Lord? Woe to those who want to play games with the Lord and to fight against his will. So there's a warning shot across the bow given to the priests to start getting their act together with regard to Louisa and what the Lord is doing with her. And Louisa said, how can I go on without you? In fact, if I am not surprised by that state, I do not see you. And he said, since it is not your will to go out of this state of sacrifice, I will find other ways to make myself seen and to be with you. Aren't you happy? So the following morning, without my losing consciousness, he made himself seen sensibly by giving me a few drops of milk to refresh me, since my weakness was extreme. So this battle between the divine will and the human will of the priests, and therefore the struggle between Christ and his church, that doesn't limit God in any way. He can find ways and means to do what he wants. So November the 22nd, 1902, Louisa is about to die, and then the priest intervenes again, and he seems to be torturing Louisa without realising he's doing it. On November the 22nd, as I kept feeling ill again, blessed Jesus came and he told me, my beloved, do you want to come? That means to come to heaven. She said, yes. Don't leave me on the earth any longer. And he said, yes, I want to content you once and for all. And as he was saying this, I felt my stomach and my throat close in such a way that nothing could enter anymore. I could barely pull a breath, feeling suffocated. And then I saw that blessed Jesus called the angels and said to them, now that the victim is coming, suspend the fortresses so that the people may do what they want. In other words, now that the protection has been taken away, now that the victim's soul has been taken away, let all the chastisements come. And Louisa said, Lord, who are they? And he said, they are the angels that keep the cities. And one of the things that the scriptures make clear to us is that, first of all, we ourselves have an angel protecting us. Families have angels. Churches have angels. Cities have angels. Countries have angels. And the terrible battle between good and evil is going on between the good angels and the fallen angels all the time. And our actions and decisions put us on one side or the other side of that battle. He said, they are the angels, and you know when you go into the book of Revelation that it is the angels all the time that carry out the will of God and bring the chastisements to the earth, because they're the ones that he's absolutely sure will in fact carry out his will. With us human beings, he never knows which side we're on. And we don't know half the time either, because we change our minds so often. So Jesus said, they are the angels who keep the cities. As long as the cities are assisted by the fortress of divine protection. Now, you really need to take real note of that, the fortress of divine protection. People just don't seem to be aware of this. If the cities are protected by the fortress of divine protection, communicated to the angels, the enemy can do nothing. But if we sin, and we sin sufficiently, then the protection will be taken away, and that is the absolute worst punishment that can be given to us. Now, if you go to the book of Ezekiel, chapter 10, verses 18 to 22, you will see the divine protection being taken away from the people when the presence of the Lord rises up from the temple, hesitates because it is his home, and leaves. But on that particular occasion, the people repented, so he came back. But when the people had grievously sinned over 400 years, the Lord allowed the divine protection to be removed from the city of Jerusalem and from the people, and their enemies, the Babylonians, came in and conquered them and took them all into slavery. So as long as that fortress of divine protection is there, the enemy can do nothing. But once this protection is removed due to the grave sins that they commit and they're left on their own, they can make revolution and all sorts of evil. Very unusually, Louisa said, I remained placid instead of getting upset. And seeing myself alone with my dear Jesus and abandoned by all creatures, so everybody's gone, the priests are paying no attention, nothing, she just has Jesus all by himself. I thanked the Lord from my heart and I prayed him to deign not to let anyone come to me to bother me. She wanted to be alone with the alone. That's called solitude. And while I was in this position, my sister came, and seeing me ill, she sent for the confessor, who managed by force of obedience to have me open my throat a little bit. And then he came out giving me the obedience not to die. So I want to give you the book of Sirach, chapter 2. You really need the whole of the chapter, because the priests are torturing Louisa. On the one hand, they won't cooperate with what the Lord wants to do. And on the other hand, they give her this awful obedience not to die. And so she is literally emotionally and physically and spiritually tortured. It's really frightening what they're doing. But if you go to the book of Sirach, now I won't give you the whole quotation. It says, my son, if you desire to serve the Lord, prepare yourself for an ordeal. And then it jumps down halfway down the page. It says, for gold is tested in the fire and chosen men are tested in the furnace of humiliation. So cling to the Lord and do not leave him. It's a wonderful chapter and will help you to understand what's going on here. So now she has the obedience not to die. She said, poor is the one who has to deal with human beings. Not only the depth of all the pains and torments of a soul, they add greater sorrows to her pains, and it's easier to obtain compassion, help and relief from God than from human beings. Rather, it seems that they get more excited. And may the Lord be always blessed who disposes everything for his glory and the good of souls. There's Louisa, absolutely surrendered to the divine will, even though she's literally being tortured by the priests. So November the 30th, 1902, this is about discernment. As I was amid fears, doubts, agitations that everything might be the work of the devil, on coming, my adorable Jesus told me, my daughter, I am the sun and I fill the whole world with light. That's 1 John 1:5. God is light. In him there is no darkness. And John 8:12. I am the light of the world. So I fill the world with light. And as I go to a soul, another sun, small s, is reproduced in her, in such a way that by dint of rays of light, they dart through each other continuously. So he comes to us, the light comes into us, and when we respond, light returns to him. Now, between the two sons, clouds are formed, which are mortifications, humiliations, adversities, sufferings, and other things. Now, I would have thought that the list was long enough without any other things. The clouds are mortifications, humiliations, adversities, sufferings, and other things. I don't know about you, but I'm not really interested in the other things. If they are true sons, they have so much power that by darting through each other continuously, they triumph over these clouds and convert them into light. Now, in this whole divine will spirituality, what the Lord is doing is trying to convert everything in us into light, because God is light. And at the moment of death, light should meet light. God is love, and he tries to transform everything in us into love. So at the moment of death, love meets love. And he wants our will to be completely and totally surrendered and given over into his will, so that at the moment of death, our will and his will meet as one. That's his plan. So I want to give you Romans 12:21 there. If though these mortifications and humiliations and so on are just apparent and false sons, the clouds which form between them have the strength to convert these sons into darkness. So it's our choice, by responding to the Lord, whether everything we experience is turned into light or the opposite, because there's only light and darkness. There isn't a grey area in between. This is the surest sign by which you can know whether it is I or the devil that's operating in you, whether everything in you is being gradually turned into light, gradually spiritualized, gradually divinized, gradually turned into love. This is the surest sign, Jesus said. And one of the lovely things in these early volumes is he gives you all this discernment so you can find out whether what is going on inside of you is real or not. And after a person has received this sign, he can lay down his life to confess the truth, which is light and not darkness. So Matthew 7:25, by their fruits you will know them, he said. So Louisa said, I've been ruminating within my mind on whether these signs are present in me, and I see myself so full of defects that I have no words to manifest my badness. However, I do not lose heart. On the contrary, I hope that the mercy of the Lord may want to have compassion on this poor creature. So December the 3rd, 1902, Louisa gets disturbed about everything that's going on. This morning, as I was in my usual state and my fears continued, when blessed Jesus came, I said to him, life of my life, how come you do not let me obey the order of my superiors? Now, when she says my superiors, she doesn't just mean the priest, she means the bishop as well. Because what the priests are doing to her is not coming from themselves, it's coming from the bishop. And we did show you sometime earlier that the bishop is still not convinced that this is from God. And Jesus said, and you, my daughter, don't you see where the opposition comes from? It's the human will that does not unite with the divine will so that they may kiss and become one. And where there is opposition between these two wills, since the divine will is superior, the human will loses by necessity. Besides, what else do they want? They are the priests and the bishop. I've told you that if they want, I will make you fall into that state. If they do not want it, I will let you obey. But as for the obedience that I should make you fall and that I should make you come round without their coming, leaving this thing independent of them and all at my disposal, he said, this is up to me. This is God's decision. And he's been demanding since Volume 1 that the priests would be involved and that the ministry of the church would be involved all the time. And the reason is something that Louisa herself doesn't know, and that is that he's going to make a major revelation to the church about the fulfillment of the Our Father, and he wants the church involved. He doesn't want it to be completely private. He wants it to be public, but he's using Louisa. So Jesus continues, "Whether I want to keep you in this state for 1 minute or a half an hour, whether I have to make you suffer or not, this remains under my care. And if they," that's the priests, "want otherwise, it would be wanting to dictate to God the laws of how and when." Human beings are very good at telling God what to do. "I am the one who must do things," Jesus said, "and this would be wanting to meddle too much in my judgments and acting as my master." So there's the church wanting to dictate to its founder. While the creature is supposed to adore, not to investigate. So obviously, Jesus is telling the priests and the bishop that they need a little bit of humility and they need to start recognizing who it is who is present. So Louisa said she was left incapable of answering. And seeing that she wasn't answering, Jesus said, "This is not wanting to persuade themselves. This not wanting to persuade themselves grieves me very much." I want to give you Ephesians 4:30 there. "You, however, in contrasts and mortifications, do not keep your gaze on them." This is terribly important, not to put your attention on the source of the disturbance, and that you keep your attention on the Lord so that he can keep you at the divine level and that you don't sink down to the level that other people are at. "You do not keep your gaze on them, but fix it on me, who was the target of contradictions. And as you suffer them, you will become more like me. In this way, your nature will not be able to move, and you will remain calm and tranquil." That's Psalm 131, verse 2. "I want that on your part, you do as much as you can to obey them, and for the rest, leave it to me. Don't become disturbed." So this is a battle between the priests and Jesus, and poor Louisa is in the middle, suffering on both sides. December the 4th, 1902. So here, Jesus tells the priests why he's doing this, but he also tells them they should have been able to work it out for themselves. So this is December the 4th, 1902. "I was thinking in my mind about disobedience, saying, the priests are right in commanding me this way. Besides, it's not such a great thing that the Lord would allow me to obey in the way that they want. So the priests say, either he should let you obey or he should tell the reason why he wants the confessor to come and make you come round from that state." He's already done this, but they're obviously looking for more information. "And while I was thinking about this, my adorable Jesus moved in my interior," that's Luke 17:21, "telling me, my daughter, I wanted them to find the reason for my operating by themselves. The church should be able to work it out. After all, the Holy Spirit is with them. And if they pray, they have the Lord enlightening them himself. He wants to talk to them, but they're not really accepting that. I wanted them to find out the reason for my operating by themselves, because in my life, from the moment I was born up to my death, everything can be found. That is, everything is found in the gospel." People are not really acting that way anymore, are they? "Everything can be found in the gospel, since the life of the whole church is enclosed in it." Now, isn't that absolutely fantastic? Put an NB beside there. "When compared to some steps that can be conformed to my life, the most difficult matters are resolved. The most tangled situations are unravelled, and in the most obscure and abstruse ones, such that the human mind almost becomes lost in that obscurity, one finds the clearest and brightest light. Everything is in the gospel. Now, the strange thing is, the church keeps saying that everything's in the gospel, that you don't need anything outside of the gospel, and yet they're not going to the gospel to find the answer to everything. This means that they, that's the priests and the bishop, do not have my life as the rule of their operating. Otherwise, they would have found the reason. In other words, they're not living a decent, deep prayer life. Otherwise, they'd know. But since they've not found the reason themselves, it's necessary that I speak and manifest it. And after this, Jesus stood up. Now, this time he's talking to the church, but it's through Louisa. And with kingly authority and power, so much that Louisa said she became fearful, he said, "What is the meaning of that ostende te sacerdoti? Show yourself to the priest." That's in Mark 1:44. It's in the first chapter. Go and show yourself to the priest. And then becoming sweeter, he said, "My power extended everywhere. And from any place, I could operate the most sensational miracles. Yet in almost all my miracles, I wanted to be personally present. As for example, when I resurrected Lazarus, which is in John chapter 11, I went there. I had them remove the sepulchral stone. And then I had him released. And then with the power and authority of my voice, I called him back to life. In resurrecting the young girl, which is in Mark 5:21, I took her by the hand, with my right hand, and I called her back to life. And in many other things which are recorded in the gospel and which are known to all, I wanted to be there with my presence. This teaches the way in which the priest must behave in his operating. He should be present when the Lord wants to do something. Since the future life of the church was enclosed in mine. And these are things that pertain to you, though in general. But to your specific circumstance, they will find the answer on Calvary," which is very interesting. "I, the priest and the victim, lifted up on the wood of the cross, wanted a priest to be present to assist me in my state of victim, and that priest was Saint John, who represented the nascent or infant church. In him, in John, I saw everyone, popes, bishops, priests, and all the faithful together. And while assisting me, he offered me as a victim for the glory of the Father and for the good outgrowth of the new church. The fact that a priest assisted me in that state of victim did not happen by chance, but everything was a profound mystery predisposed ab aeterno, that is, from all eternity, in the divine mind, intending that when I choose a soul as a victim for the grave needs present in the church, a priest must offer her to me. A priest must assist her for me, must help her and encourage her to suffer. If those things are understood, fine, they themselves will receive the fruit of the work they offered, just like St. John. How many goods did he not receive for having assisted me on Mount Calvary? If then they are not understood, they do nothing but put my work amid continuous contrast, diverting my most beautiful designs." In other words, they're not cooperating. "In addition to this," Jesus said, "my wisdom is infinite. And it does not take that soul alone, but 5, 10, as many as I please, so that not only one, but all others together may be sanctified. In fact, on Calvary, I was not alone. In addition to having the priest, I had a mother. I had friends. I also had enemies. And on seeing the prodigy of my patience," oh, put an NB beside that, Many of them believed in me for the God that I am. Oh, look at that. When you do the the Hours of the Passion, look particularly at all the actions and responses of Jesus on Calvary. And if it doesn't hit at your own impatience, and if it doesn't hit at your own pride and your own everything, you're not really understanding it. His patience absolutely undoes us poor creatures, and his humility undoes our pride, and his love undoes our selfishness. He's not the only one that's stripped on Calvary. We're all stripped. We're all stripped. And you need the courage to actually look at it. And you need the courage to respond. Jesus said, on seeing the prodigy of my patience, many of them believed in me as the God I am, and they were converted. Had I been alone, would they have received these goods? No, certainly not. But who can say everything that Jesus told me, Louisa said, or explain the minute meanings? I said this as best I could, the way I was able to say it in my roughness. I hope that the Lord will do the rest by illuminating the priests so that they may understand what he is looking for. So December the 5th, 1902, Louisa meets a woman who is crying. As I was in my usual state, blessed Jesus shared his pains with me, and as I was suffering, I saw a woman crying her heart out and saying, "The kings have joined together and the people perish." That's Psalm 2, verses 1 to 3. And not seeing themselves being helped, protected, but rather stripped, they get lost. And the kings without people cannot exist. So I want to give you Moses in Exodus 32 and Jeremiah 56 and the Acts of the Apostles chapter 4. "But what makes me cry," the woman said, "is to see that the fortresses of justice are missing, which are the victims." So what the woman was saying was, it's one thing to have this disaster happening on the earth, but if the fortresses of justice, which are the victims' souls, if they're missing, then it's hell on earth. That's what she's saying. "What makes me cry the most is to see that the fortresses of justice are missing, which are the victims' souls, the only and sole support that keeps justice back." In other words, these souls are the only ones who can stand between us and divine justice. And that is Psalm 106. So they're the only ones who can hold back divine justice in these times, which are most sad. "You at least do not, do you give me your word that you will not move from this state of victim?" And Louisa said, "I don't know why, but I felt so resolute when I answered, 'This word I cannot give you, no. I will stay as long as the Lord wants it. But as soon as he tells me that the time for this penance is ended, I will not stay for 1 minute even more.' On hearing my unshakable will, she cried more, almost wanting to move me to say yes with her crying. But more than ever resolute, I said, 'No, no.' And crying, she said, 'So there will be justice, chastisement, slaughters, and no sparing.' However, as I related this to the confessor, he told me that out of obedience, I should withdraw my no." So here is information that has been given to the priest. He must get involved. And it's Louisa saying no here that the priest begins to realise that if the victim soul is taken away, that there's going to be terrible slaughters on the earth. So at long last, he says to her that she must take away that no and say yes. So December the 7th, 1902, France and Italy no longer recognised Jesus. "As I was in my usual state, I found myself amid most thick darkness. Now, that's spiritual darkness. In it, there were thousands of people whom that darkness rendered spiritually blind, to the point that they themselves could not understand what they were doing. It seemed it was part of Italy and part of France. Oh, how many errors could be seen in France, worse than those of Italy, she said. It seemed that they had lost their human reason, the primary endowment of man, which distinguishes them from the beasts. That's very, very, very interesting, because the so-called Enlightenment happened in France. And France was the one who declared that this was the age of reason and that we didn't need religion any longer. And so France was the one who introduced atheistic materialism to the world and wanted a world without God, even though France was the eldest daughter of the church. And as part of the so-called Enlightenment, at one stage, they offered a naked woman on the altar of Notre Dame in Paris. Oh, that's the cathedral that was burnt recently. Don't you think there might be a connection? But the strange thing is that since the Enlightenment, generation after generation after generation has become less and less reasonable and more unreasonable. And we had two very unreasonable world wars that made no sense whatsoever. And so France has spread her errors all over the world. So let's come back to this. Oh, how many errors could be seen in France, worse than those of Italy. It seemed that they had lost their human reason, the primary endowment of man, which distinguishes him from the beasts. But he has become worse than the beasts themselves. Near this darkness, one could see a lamp. I approached it and I found my loving Jesus, but so afflicted and indignant with those people that I trembled like a leaf. And I said, Lord, placate yourself. Let me suffer by pouring your indignation upon me. And he told me, how can I placate myself if they want to exclude me from them? Now, what Jesus is saying, and it's only 1902, and they've succeeded. They expelled Christianity from Europe. We are now living in a pagan society. They call it post-Christian. It's just plain pagan. How can I placate myself, Jesus said, if they want to exclude me from them? And if they, as if they were a work, not a work created by me. Don't you see how France has driven me away from herself? That's with her atheistic materialism. Considering herself honoured by no longer recognising me. And how Italy wants to follow France, as there are some who would give their souls to the devil in order to win the point of forming the law of divorce. Now notice that Jesus considers the law of divorce as part of the process of rejecting him from a nation. Ireland, take note. So they even want this law of divorce after they tried so many times and were left crushed and confused. Instead of placating myself, Jesus said, and pouring my indignation upon you, I suspend you from this state of victim because after my justice has tried several times using all of its power so as not to give that chastisement wanted by man himself. And in spite of this, he still wants it. It is necessary for justice to suspend the one who holds it back and to let the chastisement fall. Now that chastisement is World War I. It's really sad. And if you have followed World War I and II, France did very badly in both. And Louisa said, Lord, if you wanted to suspend me for other chastisement, I would easily have accepted, because it's right that the creature conform to your holy will in everything. But to accept it for this evil most grave, my soul cannot digest this suspension. Rather, invest me with your power and allow me to go into the midst of these people who want this. So Louisa said, "Will you give me a chance to try and reason with them?" But of course, you can only do it with his permission and with his power. And while saying this, she said, "I found myself with them. They seem to be invested with diabolical forces, especially one of them, who seemed absolutely enraged. As though wanting to turn everything upside down, I spoke and spoke, but I could barely manage to cast a few glimmers of reason into him, making known to him the error that they were committing. And after this," she said, "I found myself inside of myself with sufferings extremely scarce." In other words, her effort was useless. Jesus was telling her the truth, that only chastisement was going to do its work. I find that extremely sad. And it's still only 1902. So December the 8th, 1902, the confessor uses the authority of the church this time. Now, this time he's really getting involved. "This morning, my adorable Jesus came and told me, 'My daughter, today I want to keep you suspended without letting you suffer.' And Louisa said, I began to fear and to lament to him, and he added, 'Do not fear, I will be with you.'" That's Joshua 1:5. "I will never leave you or desert you." It's also John 14, but I can't remember the verse. "Do not fear, I will be with you. Rather, when you occupy the state of victim soul, you are exposed to justice. And in addition to the other sufferings, many times you have to suffer my very privation and obscurity. In sum, everything that man deserves for his sins." Now Louisa hears it, that what she suffers in her privations is what human beings deserve because of their sins. They deserve to be without God, which of course is hell. "But as I suspend your office of victim, everything I will show towards you will be mercy and love." So if she's let off the hook, then everything towards her is mercy and love because of her wonderful love of God, but chastisement for the others. So Louisa said, "I felt released from my state, even though I could see my beloved Jesus, and I understood very well that it was not his coming that rendered the coming of the confessor necessary to make me come round, but rather the sufferings that Jesus would send me." At long last, she understands the reason why the priest must come, and that is that the sufferings have such an unbelievable effect on her body that she absolutely needs this help. "So I'm unable to say why my soul felt pain." Notice she says my soul, not my body. "My soul felt pain, while my nature felt great satisfaction." So her body is fine, but her soul is suffering. "If nothing else, I will spare the confessor the sacrifice of having to come. But while I was thinking of this, I saw a priest clothed in white together with our Lord. It seemed to me that he was the Pope." This is Leo XIII. So never mind the local priests and the local bishop. It seems now this time it's the Pope. So Leo XIII was talking to the Lord. "It seemed to me that he was the Pope and the confessor was with him." So this time the church is engaged. "They were praying Jesus to make me suffer so as to prevent the formation of this law of divorce." That's Matthew 18:19. There is a very definite and clear prohibition on divorce in the gospel. "But Jesus would not pay attention to them. So the confessor, heedless of the fact that he was not being given audience, with extraordinary impetus to the point that it seemed that it wasn't him, he took Jesus Christ in his arms and by force cast him inside of me." Wow, there's church authority for you. At long last, the man realizes that the church has authority from God. "You will remain crucified in her, crucifying her, but this law of divorce we do not want." So the church has made its will completely clear. Unfortunately, in our day, it's not the same. Jesus remained as though bound inside of me, crucified by such a command, and I felt bitterly the pains of the cross. Then he said, "Daughter, it's the church that wants it." And with her authority, united with the power of prayer, this binds me. Isn't it? Hasn't it taken the church quite a long time to realize that? Listen to this again. "Daughter, it is the church that wants it. And with her authority, united to the power of prayer, it binds me." So that's John 14:14, John 15:7, and verse 16b. So December the 9th, this is the following day, 1902, Louisa is crucified with Jesus. "As I was in my usual state, I found myself outside of myself together with Jesus Christ, as though nailed with him. And since I suffered, I was silent. In the meantime, I saw the confessor with my guardian angel, and the confessor said to him, 'This poor one is in great suffering to the point that she cannot speak. Give her a little respite. For when two lovers pour out together what they have in their interior, they end up conceding what they want with each other.'" Now that's pretty good on the part of the confessor. He obviously realizes that it isn't just suffering that will get it. If Louisa and Jesus are given a chance to pour out their love to each other, that the intent will be given anyway. It's a bit late, isn't it? He's a bit slow, but at least he got to the point. So I want to give you Mark 9:24 and Mark 12:23-26. And that's the praying with authority. And Jesus says, if you pray with authority and you don't doubt in any way, you'll get it. You can even get mountains to shift, which is what they're doing. So also the priest is showing a little bit of compassion to Louisa, which is a bit unusual as well. So Louisa said, "I felt my sufferings being mitigated. And first I told Jesus about certain needs of the priest, praying him to make him all for God. Because when one becomes so, God can find no difficulty in conceding to him what he wants, because he will only be able to seek the will of God." So he asks, she asks the Lord to bring the priest into union with him, because that's the most powerful position that he can have when it comes to pray. And then she said, "Lord, what about this law of divorce? Will people come to make it in Italy?" And he said, "My daughter, the danger exists unless some Chinese thunderbolt comes to prevent their intent." And Louisa said, "Lord, what do you mean? Is this perhaps someone from China who when they are about it, will take some thunderbolt and will cast it in the midst to kill them and so on?" In other words, she completely misunderstands what Jesus says. And Jesus said, "When you don't understand, it's better to keep silent." And Louisa said, "I was left confused and didn't dare to speak anymore without understanding the meaning." Jesus said, "Unless something major happens, it's going to happen. They will do it. However, my guardian angel was saying to the confessor, in addition to the intention of the cross, united to that of having him poor, if you obtain this, you will win this point, and they will not be able to do it." So the guardian angel is telling the priest that if you manage to get Louisa really suffering for this, she'll win. The point will be won. So December the 15th, Louisa remains crucified with Jesus. So this is a huge battle that's going on. And the Lord absolutely insisted on the church getting involved. "Continuing in my usual state, I found myself outside of myself," Louisa said, "and I found my adorable Jesus cast to the ground, crucified, with everyone trampling upon him. In order to prevent them from doing this, I laid myself upon him, so as to receive upon myself what they were doing to our Lord. And while I was in that position, which is Colossians 1:24, I said, Lord, what is it to you to allow those very nails that pierce you to pierce me as well? At that moment, I found myself nailed with the very nails that pierced blessed Jesus, he underneath, I on top. So that's our position of co-redeemer. In that position, we found ourselves in the midst of those men who want divorce. And Jesus was sending them many rays of light. In other words, they were receiving huge grace to help them to make their decision. And these rays of light were produced by the sufferings that Jesus and Louisa were suffering. And they remained dazzled and confused with this light. Louisa also understood that if the Lord would please to let her continue to suffer, when they came to do that, in other words, this business about the law of divorce, they would be humiliated and will not be able to conclude anything. So after this, Jesus disappeared and Louisa remained alone. Then later he came back again, but he was not crucified. He threw himself into Louisa's arms, but he was so heavy, she said, that my poor arms couldn't hold him, and I was about to let him fall to the ground. Seeing that, as much as I did and tried, I could not hold that weight. My pain was such that I felt myself crying my heart out. And Jesus, seeing the certain danger of falling and also my crying, cried along. What a harrowing scene. Then, forcing myself up, Louisa said, I kissed him on his face. He too kissed me. And I said to him, my life and my strength, by myself I am weak and can do nothing. That's John 15:5. But with you I can do everything. That's Philippians 4:13. Therefore, strengthen my weakness by infusing your very strength into me, and I will be able to carry the weight of your person. The only way to be able to spare each other this sorrow, for me letting you fall and for you the having to suffer the fall. So this 2 Corinthians 12:9. My power works best in weakness. So you see that Jesus teaches Louisa not by giving her theoretical teaching, but by letting her experience things. And then she comes around to understand what she has experienced. And so she's going to learn the meaning of that weight. On hearing this, Jesus said, my daughter, don't you understand the meaning of my heaviness? Know that it is the enormous weight of justice which I can no longer bear, nor can you hold it. And man is about to be crushed under the weight of divine justice. That's World War I. On hearing this, Louisa cried, and he, almost to distract her, since before he came, she had a strong fear that she mightn't be able to obey with regard to certain things. And Jesus said, and you, my beloved, why do you fear so much that I may not let you obey? Don't you know that when I draw, unite and identify a soul with me, as John 14:23, communicating my secrets to her, the first key I place, which produces the most beautiful sound and communicates the sound to all other keys, is the key of obedience. So much so that if the other keys are not in communication with the first keys, they will sound in a discordant way, which can never be pleasant in my hearing. Therefore, do not fear. Besides, it will not be you, but I myself will obey in you. Now, Louisa and Jesus are so united that he is living his life in her. He has bilocated himself into Louisa and is living his life again on the earth. So he says to her, listen, it's me that's doing the obeying, not just you. And so he is obeying inside of us. It's absolutely amazing. I myself will obey in you, and since it will be up to me to obey, let me do it, without being concerned, for I alone know well what must be done and how to make myself known. Having said this, he disappeared, and I found myself inside of myself, she said. So that's John 14, 17b. Now, right from the very beginning, obedience has been the key to everything with Louisa. And the Lord couldn't have brought her to the heights that he has taken her to if she wasn't willing to take out her PhD in obedience. So December the 17th, 1902. This testimony of Louisa's obedience has been made ready for our generation, where obedience has disappeared. Everybody's doing their own thing. Everybody has their own truth. Everybody has their own reality. And nobody accepts guidance from anybody else. And so it's a testimony to us as to the falseness of the life that we've moved into. So December the 17th, 1902, in order to be a victim soul, permanent union with Jesus is actually necessary. This morning, when my adorable Jesus came, Louisa said, I was praying him to placate himself, saying to him, Lord, if I cannot sustain the weight of your justice by myself, there are so many good souls among whom it can be divided, a little bit each, so that it might be easier to bear the weight and people might be spared. So she's trying to work out how we can stop this terrible chastisement from coming. And he says, she says, you know, why don't you just spread out the weight? And he said, and you, my daughter, don't know that if my justice is to unload the weight of someone else's chastisement upon some soul, this soul must be in possession of permanent union with me. So he says to her, there's no possibility of doing what you've asked unless the soul you're talking about has reached permanent union with me. Now, in the crisis that Louisa is revealing here in the church and in the world in 1902, where are all these souls? They must have permanent union with me in such a way that everything the soul does, suffers, intercedes for, and obtains is given to her by virtue of the union with God established within her. As the soul does nothing but lay down her own will and uniting herself with the Lord's. So, for other people to bear this weight of divine justice, they would have to be in permanent union with the Lord, and their own will would have to be absolutely submitted to that of the Lord. Nor could my justice do this without first giving the soul the necessary graces to be able to suffer. In other words, we can't do it by ourselves. That's John 15:5. Louisa isn't taking into account that the Lord has given her absolutely gigantic grace, and that he has worked prodigies of miracles in her soul to bring her to the place that she's in. He said, I'd have to first of all give the soul the necessary graces to be able to suffer for the sake of somebody else. Most of us find it hard enough to suffer sufferings that come to us without us being wanting it. The sufferings that come to us through our own problems or through other people or through what is happening all around us, we find that hard enough to take. Jesus is talking about a person who is willing to suffer voluntarily for others. And Louisa said, but how can union with you be permanent in me? I see myself so bad. Now, Louisa keeps saying this because the closer one gets to God and touches the enormous, inexplicable, untouchable, unidentifiable purity of God, that all we see is the absolute awfulness of human nature. But that doesn't mean she's sinning. And Jesus interrupting my words said, "Silly one, what are you saying? Don't you feel me continuously within yourself?" That's Luke 17:21. Now, feel me. One of the definitions that's given of contemplation is that a person has a sense of the presence of God within them. They have it all around them as well, but they have it within them. And Jesus says, "Don't you recognize my presence within you? Don't you perceive the sensible movements that I make in your interior?" In other words, Jesus has bilocated himself into Louisa. Because, I mean, she often says, "I saw his hand and I pulled it out." "Don't you perceive the sensible movements I make in your interior and the continuous prayer that rises within your interior and you can't do otherwise? Is this perhaps you and not I who dwell in you?" It's 1 Corinthians 3:16. "Know you not that you are the temple of the living God and that the Spirit of God dwells in you?" "At the most, sometimes you do not see me, but in no way does this mean that the union with me is not permanent in you." And Louisa says she remained confused. It's amazing to me that someone at this level of union with the Lord would not understand it. So December the 18th, 1902, Jesus again takes Louisa to suffer with him to conquer this terrible law of divorce. "As soon as I found myself in my usual state, blessed Jesus came, but in such suffering as to arouse compassion. Then, all afflicted, he told me, 'My daughter, come again to suffer with me in order to conquer the obstinacy of those who want divorce.' 'Let's try once more,' he said. 'You'll always be ready to suffer what I want, won't you? Do you give me your consent?'" Now, this is very important. Louisa has long since laid down her will before the Lord, but we are always free. The Lord will never coerce us in any way. And the difference between that and the way the devil works is that the devil does take over your will if he's given a chance and gives you less and less and less freedom, so that the person experiencing possession has actually no freedom of their will. It has been taken from them. And so Jesus said to her, "Do you give me your consent?" And Louisa said, "Yes, Lord, do whatever you want." "As soon as I said yes, blessed Jesus laid himself within me as crucified. And since my nature was smaller than his, he stretched me so as to make me reach his very person. And then he poured very little, yes, but so bitter and full of sufferings, that not only did I feel the nails at the places of the crucifixion, but I felt my whole body as pierced with many nails, in such a way that I felt all of myself being crushed. He left me in that position for a little while, and I found myself in the midst of demons," Louisa said, "who, on seeing me suffer like that, said, 'In the end, this damn one is going to win again, so that we don't make this law of divorce.'" So what is happening here is that not only is Louisa finding out that it is the demons who are behind the law of divorce, but the Lord is trying to tell you and me as well. And unfortunately, we're living not only in an age where divorce is permitted, but where we allow the breakup of marriage in an absolutely extraordinary way. It really is. And we don't realise that this is an attack of hell upon the church. So Louisa said, "I found myself in the midst of demons who are saying, 'In the end, this damn one is going to win again, so that we don't make the law of divorce.' 'Curse your existence,' the demons said to Louisa. 'You try to harm us and to disperse our business by ruining our many toils, rendering them vain. But we'll make you pay for this.'" Now, that's the one thing that anybody who tries to work for the Lord and manages to succeed even in something small, that the demons make sure you pay. We, they said, will move bishops, priests and people against you. That's their revenge against Louisa. So that next time we'll make you drop this whim of accepting sufferings. And while saying this, they sent me whirls of flames and smoke. I felt myself in so much suffering that I could not understand myself, but blessed Jesus came back. At the sight of Jesus, the demons fled. After all, Jesus is Lord. And again, he renewed in me the same sufferings, but more intense than before. So I want to give you Philippians 2, 9 to 10. Let this mind be in you that was also in Christ Jesus. Jesus repeated this two more times, and even though I was almost constantly with Jesus, I could not say anything to him because I was as though compressed by strong sufferings. He would say to me from time to time, "My daughter, it's necessary that you suffer for now. Have patience. Do you not want to take care of my interests as if they were your own?" Now for that, I want to give you the Song of Songs, chapter 6, verses 11 to 12, that the bride interests herself in all that pertains to the bridegroom. And Jesus would sustain me in his arms, for my nature could not bear by itself the weight of those sufferings. Okay, so that's Philippians 4:13 and John 15:5 again. Then Jesus said to me, "Beloved, do you want to see the evil that occurred during those days in which I kept you suspended?" Because Louisa doesn't really take on board the effect that her relationship with the Lord has on the world. "At that moment, I don't know," she said. "I don't know how, but I saw justice and I could see it as full of light, grace, chastisements and darkness. And as many days as I had been suspended, so many were the streams of darkness that descended upon the earth." Oh, dear. Now, you see, you need to understand the way chastisement works. Darkness goes up from the earth and darkness cannot enter the kingdom of God. God is light. So it's sent right back to us in chastisement. Filthiness comes up from the earth. Nothing unworthy or unholy can enter the presence of God. And the filthiness is sent right back to us as chastisement. In other words, we create the chastisements, as Jesus explains over and over and over again. I always say there's a post office up in Dublin that stamps all this stuff with "return to sender." So she said that during the days of that in which she was suspended, so many were the streams of darkness that descended upon the earth. Those who want to do evil and speak evil had become even more blind and had acquired strength to carry it out, turning against the church and against what Louisa calls sacred people. That means priests, religious, and those committed to the Lord. And she said, "I was surprised, and Jesus told me, 'You thought it was nothing, so much so that you would not bother about it, but it wasn't that way. Have you seen how much evil came about and how much strength the enemies acquired to the point of managing to do what they had not been able to do during the time which I had you continuously kept in this state?'" Now, this message isn't so much needed by Louisa as by the priests and by the bishop. They were fighting against the Lord. And they were trying to say that Louisa is nothing, you know, this is not really from God and blah, blah, blah. And so the Lord then decided he would teach them the only way they could learn. And that is, he suspended Louisa. And during the time that Louisa was suspended, all this evil came upon the earth. Surely they'd learn from that. And so they have it here now. It's actually written for them. Because Louisa just concentrates so completely on the Lord that she doesn't look at what's happening to herself. December the 24th, 1902. Jesus tests Louisa to ignite in her the desire to suffer and love more. Continuing in my usual state, I found myself outside of myself, and I found our Lord, who had a cross near him, which was all braided with thorns. He took it and he placed it upon my shoulders, commanding me to carry it out into the midst of a multitude of people. Now, the cross is given by Jesus himself, and I want to give you Matthew 16, 24 to 26. Everybody, not just Louisa, must carry their cross. So he took it and he placed it upon my shoulders, commanding me to carry it into the midst of a multitude of people to give proof of his mercy and to placate divine justice. She said the cross was so heavy that I carried it bent over and almost dragging myself. That's her description of Jesus on the road to Calvary, bent over, almost in half, dragging the thing after him. While I was carrying it, Louisa said, Jesus disappeared. And as I reached a certain place, the one who was guiding me, that's an angel, said, leave the cross and remove your clothes. Because after all, when Jesus arrived at Calvary, he also was stripped. For our Lord is coming back and he must find you ready for crucifixion. I removed my clothes, but I kept them in my hands because of the embarrassment my nature felt. And I said to myself, I'll drop them as soon as he comes. At that moment, he came back and finding me with my clothes in my hands, he said to me, you have not even let yourself be found completely stripped so that I might crucify you immediately. You see, the awful thing is that Jesus had to be completely stripped. He was stripped at least three times during the whole passion thing. Well, then, Jesus said, we'll have to leave it for another time. And Louisa said, I remained confused and afflicted, unable to articulate a word. And Jesus, to console me, took me by the hand and told me, tell me, what do you want me to give you? So he tries to distract her. And she said, Lord, suffering. And he said, and what else? And Louisa said, I can ask you nothing but suffering. And Jesus said, and what about love? Do you want some? And Louisa said, no, suffering, because in giving me suffering, you will give me more love. I know this by experience. Look how clever she is. And she doesn't miss anything. I know by experience that in order to obtain graces, the strongest love and all of you, these cannot be obtained except through voluntary suffering. She understands well. And in order to earn all your sympathy, delight and satisfactions, the only means is to suffer for love of you. So Louisa has understood this. He said, my beloved, I wanted to test you so as to ignite in you more the desire to suffer for love of me. In other words, to make her an even more powerful victim than she is. After this, Louisa said, oh yeah, I want to give you Luke 14, 11. He who humbles himself will be exalted. After this, I saw people who believed themselves to be something greater than others. Oh, she meets the pride. And blessed Jesus said, my daughter, one who believes himself to be something before me and before men is worth nothing. That's Luke 18, 9 to 14. Do you remember the Pharisee in the temple? He really thought he was something. One who believes himself to be nothing is worth everything. That's Luke 17, 10 and Luke 14, 11. The one who believes himself to be nothing, and in other words, in this divine will spirituality, we are encouraged to get into our nothingness and stay there to let God work with us. So the one who believes himself to be nothing is worth everything, first before me, because if he does something, he doesn't think that he does it, because he can do it, having the strength and the capacity, but rather because he receives from God the grace, the helps and the lights. That's Philippians 4:13. Therefore, it can be said he does it by virtue of divine power. And one who has divine power is already worth everything 2 Corinthians 12:9. Second, before men, because this acting by virtue of divine power makes him operate in a completely different way. And he does nothing but send forth light, the light of divine power he contains within himself, in such a way that the most perverted ones, without wanting it, feel the strength of this light and submit to his volition. And here is how he's worth everything also before men. So that's Matthew 5:17. Let your light shine so that men will give glory to God. On the contrary, one who believes himself to be something in addition to being worth nothing is abominable in my presence, Luke 16:15. And because of his ostentatious and particular manners, that's Matthew 6, verses 1 to 18, for he believes he is something and he makes fun of others. Men keep him pointed out as an object of derision and of persecution. Matthew 15, verses 8 to 9, and Psalm 49. So here you have Jesus explaining the necessity for us to have humility, and humility is the absolute foundational thing. If we don't have humility, we have literally nothing. We're going nowhere. In spiritual things, the way up is down. But also, when you consider people building skyscrapers, the higher they want to go, and the stronger the building has to be to withstand the hurricanes, the deeper the foundations have to go. It's actually that simple. And so Jesus tells us, make sure you take out your PhD in humility. And nothingness is a wonderful thing. It's way beyond humility. There's nothing to be humble about because you are nothing, which I think is absolutely fantastic. And I think one of the great things in the divine will thing is that we enter into our nothingness and we stay there and we let the Lord have complete freedom to do what he wants. So I'm going to leave it there for the moment.